Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest George Saunders, particularly because I've been talking to George since he began writing. And George Saunders is one of the inevitable cases where you have to say, this is a guy who's grown as a writer, and that his most recent book, 10th of December, is his deepest. Tell me, it's a crazy, unjustifiable question, but how does it feel to know that your work is deepening?
Well, it's really, it's good. I mean, and you know, of course, the real benefit is that you feel it as you're doing it. In other words, it hasn't become a knee-jerk thing or a habitual thing, but you're kind of genuinely puzzled every day when you go in, like, well, I still don't know what I'm doing. And the other really nice thing is that your actual concerns and fears and so on get in there. If you were sort of not growing, you'd still be working off the old fears and desires and so on. So this book in particular, I kind of was, you know, the last time we talked in the studio was around the time of that essay collection, and that got a little bit of press, and I also, it was during the Iraq War, and I think I had my mind to kind of try to be a more public writer. You know, I went on TV and stuff, and I was doing I was doing some different kinds of writing, some humor and screenwriting and stuff. And then somewhere just after I started what would be this book, I just said, you know what, I'm going to quit. I'm just going to only write fiction. And so I got this little writing shed that we rehabbed. And so for about, you know, 5 or 6 of those years, I was mostly doing only fiction. And then for the last 4, only doing fiction. So that was weird. It was like the, you know, if your desire to write and your talent, such as it is, could be understood as a river. I think I'd been kind of siphoning it off or kind of making little brooks out of it. And so then I just quit. And suddenly the river felt like it was getting deeper and just a lot more fun to work every day, actually.
When I first started reading you, I would think, why is George Saunders doing such terrible things to his characters, making them suffer so much? And I accused you of a kind of authorial sadism, both
I remember
to the character,
just where we were when you said that. And yeah, go ahead. No, I mean, I say that because it was deep for me. I've had every conversation we've had, you said something that has then affected the trajectory of my work afterwards. And that was very meaningful to me when we had that conversation.
Now, somehow or other, although they take place in science fiction worlds or in the unbelievably strange corridors of corporations, postmodern corporations, somehow over time you've managed to convince me that God and life and capitalism have done these things to these characters, and that you're with your narrator trying to fend off the next blow. That's quite an accomplishment.
Oh, thanks.
Can I ask you how you did it?
Well, I think it's process related, in the sense that, you know, if a person enters a story, writing a story with some intention, whether it's sort of political or propagandistic or even aesthetic, they're quickly going to be found out, I think. There's a kind of innate condescension in that attitude. And of course, we all do that. I mean, you can't, it's terrifying to start a story without some idea of how to proceed. But as Donald Barthelme says in that essay that I know we both love, Not Knowing. Yeah. You know, that really is the first job, is to not know what you're going to do. So then, for me anyway, the way that's developed is to just have a sort of infinite field ahead of me of revision. A story is not done until it's done, and if it takes 12 years or 1,600 drafts, it doesn't really matter. So that process, I think, is a way of kind of making the narrative logic ironclad, so that anything the reader objects to will have been taken into account in some way by me because I've read this sucker, you know, 7,000 more times than she has. So I think that part of that effect, which I'm really glad that the stories have that effect, but part of that is just that I have really been through it to try to eliminate the places where my intimacy with you as a reader would have gotten disrupted by sloth, you know, or by some kind of inadvertent condescension on my part to your reading abilities.
Well, it is still hard to read your stories for me because the sadness is so, well, nearly unbearable. It still feels like being kicked in the stomach, having the air pulled out of me. But I do now see that it's not you doing it, that our times have conspired to make us see how if we don't have some kind of courage, some kind of compassion, and, dare I say it, the ability to tell our stories, we're really going to sink. These are hard times, aren't they, George?
They are. I think they are, but also they've probably always been, in the sense that we aren't really born very well equipped to the struggles that we're going to go through. You know, we're kind of born with this idea that we're permanent and we're central and we're enduring and we're the most interesting person in the room. And then, especially in times like these where, you know, my feeling is that, you know, when I was growing up, there was the sort of thing was that capitalism was in a battle with socialism and communism. And anarchy was sort of the crazy uncle over there on the side. And now in our time, I think capitalism has just won. There's no question. It's just an overwhelming victory for capitalism. But I think we're in an interesting time in it. Maybe capitalism is trying to decide which capitalism it's going to be. And it seems to me that just in my lifetime, it's kind of decided or been decided that the form of capitalism we're going to embrace is the one that says, if you got it, you deserve it. No guilt. Don't worry about it. And anybody who doesn't like that is whining. Whereas the one I like is a sort of Emersonian, Whitman-esque form, which says there's no point in any of this democracy and capitalism if we're not simply making more citizens, making brighter citizens, making the lives of the least among us better. So I think it's in some kind of weird, diffuse way, fiction can remind us that even those people are on a continuum with us, and that remembering that actually ennobles us.
And your stories are stories of this time, caught in that crux of people are suffering, and yet if you got it, you deserve it.
Right. I can remember being, you know, in Catholic school as a kid, and the notion of beneficent paternalism was absolutely assumed. It was assumed that anybody who didn't think that way was a dope, you know, and kind of a jerk. And it was interesting to see that slowly evolve into this thing now where you're actually kind of old-fashioned if you invoke that idea, except that, you know, I do a lot of readings in college, and that is not a new or foreign idea to all, you know, most of the young writers I meet. That's something that they get. So I think I don't feel hopeless about it, but I think that it's a time for us who feel that way to be a little bit belligerent and to say, no, it's not, you know, I'm not negotiating about the responsibility to be kind to people who are unfortunate. That's not a negotiable point. It's not something to debate on TV. It's essential to who we are. And if you don't do it, what's the point of this, all this falderal of having a country like ours? If all this energy and effort and productivity is just to serve more productivity, that's pretty depressing. But if it's to say there are people among us who are suffering every day because of paucity of means, and we could rejigger the whole enterprise to somehow at least think of them, that's really the only way to go. Otherwise, it's going to be a revolution or a suppressed revolution, which is even worse.
I'm talking to George Saunders on the occasion of the publication of his newest collection of stories, 10th of December. Now, you write mostly stories and short pieces, and I was just jotting down on my little piece of paper here that the names of writers who are known almost entirely for their stories. Of course, Carver, Anne Beattie, I think, always regarded the novels as being experiments. What she knew how to write is a short story and still writes them brilliantly. Donald Barthelme, too, the two or three longer books are very small, but he wrote short stories. And I would say that it goes all the way back to Hemingway, that if we were really being honest, Hemingway's stories are what last, yeah. And the novels, not quite. Maybe The Sun Also Rises. Do you try to write novels? Is it in your future?
It's in my future and my past, and they always just shrink. Several of the stories in this book, you have that early rush where you go, oh, this is it, this is the one. And then somehow, I'm guessing it's kind of neurological that I just have a fast twitch narrative muscle. So I have tried them, and they've shrunk. And I'd like to try it, but I'm thinking maybe that there's a, I've always thought of a novel as an exercise in extension. And if I did write one, I think it might be something else. It might be just a collection of bursts, you know. But I actually kind of gave up worrying about that a while ago. And I think my little talent is such a thin ledge that I seriously, I've had so many times where I thought, oh, now I'll just be more expansive. And the thing that resulted just didn't do anything for anybody, including me, first and foremost. So I kind of took this, attitude that I just would like to, be in there somewhere and do something that had some urgency. And so far, I'll get a big long thing and it doesn't have urgency, but if I cut it by 2/3 or something, it'll suddenly get infused with urgency. So I'm very happy to take that instruction from the world and keep it short.
When I was reading your title story, 10th of December, I thought that you had broken through to something that might become, in the long run, novelistic. These characters seem to be psychically interconnected as if they were branches of one another. They do meet physically, but the story seems to have prepared for this old man and this young boy to meet on a unearthly precognitive level. And I thought, oh, I bet this is how George is going to figure out how to write a novel. It seemed a bit different from anything I've ever seen. I mean, I don't want to be ridiculous, but Marguerite Duras has her way of doing this kind of thing. But this sense that these characters are coming from a deep pool of self from which individuals emerge fascinated me in that story.
That's really, that's interesting because in a sense, that's where characters come from, is this pool in your own brain, I have often thought, I can imagine a novel I would love to write, which is something, I always think Tolstoyan in the sense that you'd have 16 or 17 people who were all distinguishable in their diction, in their that sort of internal thought. And then in a certain way, anything that happens in that pool of people is pretty novelistic. But the fight I've been fighting since we met back in 96, 97 is that's a nice idea, but if you can't get the prose to sit up and dance, it's just an idea. And the way that my prose has gotten energized over the years is, as you pointed out once to me, through a kind of cruelty, a kind of a antagonistic, action-causing motion, and also through humor. So the thing I've been trying to get to was, can I make 7 or 8 different people whose speeches are different and are energized? That's hard, actually, and are funny. That's really hard. And so, to get even in that story, there's 2 different people, and in another story in the book, there's 3.
Uh-huh.
But you reach the limit of the form, because Tolstoy will basically be Tolstoy always, and he'll drop in his Tolstoyan diction into the mind of a horse or a young woman, but he's always Tolstoy telling you what that person is thinking. So this approach is a little different because you're actually trying to use their diction.
Yes, but you're trying to throw yourself into another body and ventriloquize.
That's right. I call it third person ventriloquism. So the problem is, how many different voices can one person do?
In this book, it's not just the voices of the people, their diction, it's genre. At the beginning of 10th of December, you have a sort of Tolkienish child's fantasy of going out into the world to meet hobbits or some variant of them. Mm-hmm. You also have this kind of funny chivalric romance tone, which I think Donald used to do too sometimes, Donald Barthelme, the great American short story writer, sometime humorist. But I think that between voices and genres, you probably have the mix for a novel. As you say, it's just an idea, and the proof is in phrase by phrase by phrase. Does it live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's funny to me, too, how the subconscious will cough up things that are totally off the controlling narrative, you know. So I'm working on a mystery project now that I really like that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, at least on the surface. It's a very different kind of thing. And the thing that's energizing about it is I think it'll probably fail. It seems like it should fail. And it's actually putting a lot of the stuff that I consider fun or easy off to the side. So I don't know. It's a fun, and you know, we talked about in the past, we've talked about growth and how important that is. And I think part of that is to always kind of go, yeah, you know, I wrote these stories. Okay. I still haven't gotten to where I want to go. So let's just forget everything. Just literally just forget everything and try to engage with the new prose as in as, you know, sort of blank or naked a state as you can, as sort of non-conceptual, and just looking at it to see if it's giving you any pleasure, whatever it might be on that day.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with George Saunders about his book of stories, 10th of December, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his new book, 10th of December, a collection of short stories that delves into the heart of morality, war, sex, love, and class with humor, tenderness, and biting observation. Now, George, I was wondering, do you think that you're turning to a mystery project? I've been thinking, you know, people ask me, why don't you do thrillers and mysteries on Bookworm? Why don't you? And I realize it's because so many people die in those books, but you only go to one funeral. Because you can't keep writing about funerals for each and every character. And the upsurge of grief is so terrible that by the time the book is done, I can hardly read it because the grief has been surgically removed from the narrative. I can't deal with death without crying about it. How are you feeling about the subject of grief? Because your work compels more grief than any other living writer I can think of.
Well, I think you're a very, very, you know, generous and gentle-hearted reader. So, to be honest, you know, as you're working on stuff, at first it's a death, but it's also a story point, and so you're kind of seeing it double-headedly. You know, you see it as a sad turn in the story, and my feeling is always when I put in something that's violent or dark or cruel. I feel like you got to sort of do a gut check and say, okay, wait a minute, are you just being gratuitous? Is this an avoidance, or are you going to be able to make something profound out of it? So, in other words, are you going to be able to use this to raise the bar in some way? It's maybe a little bit like joking, you know, like when we were kids in Chicago, one of the daring but dangerous things you could do in Catholic school was to bark out a joke all of a sudden. You know, there'd be some funny comic energy in the room. And the person who would say it would get a big laugh and often would get in trouble. So you sort of had to say, you know, if I say this thing, is it going to be worth it? In terms of my branding here in seventh grade, if I say it, is it going to be worth it? So I think part of my idea about the cruelty or the sadness is that, first of all, sadness is real. You know, we all get there. We all know it. Death, all these things. So it's got to go in the literature. Otherwise, it's nonsense. It's silly. But also, sadness is not universal. It's not every day that we're sad. There are, you know, thankfully, long periods of bliss here on Earth. You know, I had a similar thing. I went out to Fresno a couple of years ago and lived in a homeless camp incognito for a week to do a piece for GQ. And in the middle of that, that was a very painful, scary, but also deeply sad, like sad beyond sad, because it didn't seem, I didn't like the way I was reacting to it. I didn't like the just nonstop nature of the kind of fighting and aggression and lying and so on. And I had a couple incidents in that story that I thought, oh, I really don't feel good about this, or maybe I should leave this out, or maybe I should just get out of here. But every night I would kind of have a talk with myself and say, okay, this is really happening in the world. I didn't know it was happening, but now that I'm here, I know it's happening. And I felt this kind of old adolescent love for truth, you know, that sense that you would rather die than withhold some truth. So I think there's some element of that in fiction, that if you don't put some of the sadness in, you're a baby. But if you put too much in, if you put it in gratuitously as an easy buzz, you're also kind of a baby.
I acknowledge it. A baby and sort of a world-class wuss.
You're an old soul. You're a deep and gentle man. Let's go with that version.
Well, let's go with that version. But I think it's something, you know, we all know. Don Quixote on, reading is dangerous. It's nothing for a coward to be engaged with. And so is writing. And I think that you're right, that a reader has to allow fiction to not only sensitize him, me, but also toughen him up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writing, if I'm not going to face the world bully by bully, I have to let stories bully me sometimes into
right.
submission. Yeah.
Well, also that, you know, I sometimes, you know, I have to remind myself it's a game. A story is not, you're not actually making these things happen. It's a game. It's a high level, enjoyable game in which the very complicated thing is happening between reader and writer, which is I'm saying, okay, you know this is a game. I know this is a game. Let's pretend it's not. Let's really play it together. And the reader says, all right, let's do. And then you get going. And I think at the end of that whole thing, one thing that's happened is an energy transfer, if you do it right. I've had a certain energy of creation, and you have a certain energy in reception.
That's brilliant, George, but what's the difference between that and marriage?
None. None. No, I think none. You know, it's a intimate relationship. And what I know, I mean, I don't know, you know, in these interviews, sometimes you develop a shtick about what literature does for the world, you know. But I always want to go back and read something mind-blowing and then watch my own reaction to it. And I just read Horatio Moya, The Senselessness, a wonderful novel. And what I noticed happening was just like there were certain dormant, humane things in me that kind of almost got, almost like a peacock tail. They just went up,
yes.
You know, when I read that book. And they stayed up for maybe 4 or 5 hours afterwards. And they're, you know, so just that kind of that dormant, humane thing gets re-energized for a while. That to me seems sufficient, and it doesn't have to be fancy. You know, we all know that feeling of reading a book and having your clock cleaned, and for some number of hours afterwards, the world seems more beautiful and luminous. And somehow, in a complicated way, you're more in it than you were before. And in a really good book, that I think you could make the shaky argument that you're not only in it more, but you're in it in a better way temporarily.
Yes, and tell me, though, because I've often felt that sentimental movies are punishing, too, because when I see, for instance, It's a Wonderful Life, and I leave the theater, I think, oh, my, I have to leave the theater and go back into that cruel, ungenerous world that isn't there in Bedford Falls. We're stuck with life itself. Do books need to return you to the world as a better person, or isn't it sometimes unusual just to affect a change, not
right.
a change in quality, but to cause your jaw to drop?
Yes, I agree with the second thing you said. I think you get into very thin ice when you start saying what a book should or can or must do, especially as an artist, because you don't know what it's going to do, you know, and you are really lucky if it does anything. Sometimes I say, well, it should do something non-random. In other words, reading the phone book does something, but, you know, But actually, it's funny how as an artist, that's all sort of unnecessary talk when you're actually doing it, because you know when a scene is full of BS and when it's not delivering. You know, and you don't really know. You maybe couldn't say it or articulate it, but you know that this scene is not energetic, and your instincts tell you how to fix it. And you don't, you know, you're not thinking about the ultimate purpose. You think about that when you're done. And frankly, you know, when you're at the stage where you're promoting a book and you're talking about it, or if you're teaching, you know, you have to, it's criticism, and that's a wonderful discipline in and of itself. But it's funny how I think most writers I've talked to, in the moment of doing it, they know very well what they're trying to do. But it's a gut thing. You know, you're trying to make the story more considerable, more dangerous. Again, I'm conceptualizing again. It's kind of a dangerous notion to say that fiction has to make the reader better, because then you reduce the story to a kind of a commodity that because then at some point some fascist shows up and says, we notice your book isn't producing good effects. You know, you get to go to jail. So I think better to be in that really uncomfortable position of saying, we don't know what it does. We like what it does. But because we're artists and we're engaged readers, we don't have to actually nail it down. If it, you know, it's like porn. We know it when we see it. So, but isn't it hard, you know, to sort of exist in a state where you're not trying to articulate a thing? Just go, yeah, fiction's cool.
I've been talking with George Saunders, author most recently of 10th of December Stories. The New York Times had a magazine section that proclaimed on its cover, the best book you'll read this year is George Saunders' 10th of December. That's coming out of a fortune cookie. I've experienced this book. It's not just a prediction. It's a really, really good book. Thank you, George, for joining me.
Always such a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Andres Bolens at Dry Hill Studios. Thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jamaica Kincaid is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.